Hey, welcome to the Gig Life Podcast. I'm your host, Stevie Taylor. My guest today is Kerry Jacobson. Kerry is a drummer originally from Wellington in New Zealand, but he moved to Sydney to join Dragon. He's played on all those big hits for Dragon, April Sun in Cuba, Are You Old Enough, Rain, just to name a few. Kerry also plays in Mondo Rock and has been the longtime tubsman for the great Ian Moss. Let's get into it, eh? This is episode 148. Kerry Jacobson, here we go. I'll never get used to that noise.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Oh, didn't you? Oh, I got a really loud like brrrr in my ears. I think we're rolling. Kerry Jacobson, welcome to the Gig Life Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Stevie. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's an honour to meet you. And you know, first thing I want to say is I'm glad you've, because you had a bit of a health scare last year.
Recently.
Yeah.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just out of the blue. Didn't even know it was coming. Heart attack last October 2023, and here I am, fit and healthy and better than ever. Yeah. Thanks to the great work at the Royal Brisbane Hospital cardiac team there. So yeah, I'm a very lucky man, and of course my partner who saved my life. I can't even remember it happened in my sleep, and I didn't even know it was coming. But now I've just got a couple of stents in my heart and, of course, on a bit of medication. But fit as a fiddle.
Man.
And very lucky and happy.
So you were asleep, were you?
Apparently I was asleep and it happened in my sleep, and my partner pulled me off the bed and gave me CPR, called the ambulance, all that stuff. And here I am. And I woke up in intensive care. Spent a couple of weeks, I think, in hospital, and then just when I got out, I had a little bit of a road to recovery in terms of fitness, and that's about it. In fact, I went for a checkup. I've been going to the hospital because they do post, appointments and check you out and all that stuff, and I was doing a little bit of gym there at the hospital, and anyway, my last test a couple of weeks ago, they said I'm fighting fit, and they actually were really impressed with my recovery. So all I can say is I'm lucky to be here, and I'm obviously blessed to keep on performing for a little bit longer anyway.
Mike, it's great news, really, really great news. So were you in the middle of a tour, or did you have anything coming up?
I'm just trying to think. I don't think, because I'm still with Ian Moss, and I've been with him for, I don't know, 20-odd years, probably more.
Yep.
He last year was catching up on a lot of solo performances, which he's still catching up on, which is post-COVID when he was, I think the band couldn't work and it was a mess, so he just started to do a solo tour, and then that got cancelled. And so, long story short, there wasn't a lot of band work with him then, but of course I was doing a fair bit with my band, which is the Filthy Animals, in and around Brisbane and Queensland, which is kind of like a rock covers band. But that was formed during COVID as well, because none of us could get over the border and travel in our other bands. So it was my girlfriend said to me, well, why don't you just form a band of players that live in Brisbane, and, you know, kind of a covers band thing. And I thought, well, you know, and or she said, well, why don't you get people from named bands? And I just happened to know Brett Williams from the Choir Boys, had just moved up here into Brisbane, and a couple of bass players. I knew Lee Novak from Savage Garden. He did the original tour with them, and a few others. And we got this band together, and it's just been going nuts, gangbusters. So that's what I was doing leading up to this heart attack.
Mm.
And, of course, now post-heart attack, I'm back with Ian Moss and Filthy Animals and doing all that.
Yep. So how long after you had your stent surgery and your recovery did you sit down and start trying to play your drums again? And do you remember, did it sort of all come back, or did you really notice that you'd lost your fitness?
Yeah, it certainly never went away, but it was my fitness that suffered. And when I came back, I started playing with the Filthy Animals, but with another drummer. We've got a few drummers on board because it's a kind of a rotational lineup. We've got a lot of players involved. Hamish Rosser is one from Wolf Mother, drummer. Mm-hmm. And so we started to do some shows with him, and I'd come along and do maybe three songs, maybe four, five, six songs. And I did that for a few weeks. And then Tamworth Muster came up in January January with Ian Moss. And that was my first big gig back with him. And so, I was working my way up gradually, but what I did with that one was I just booked a rehearsal studio and just started playing along to some of his live tracks and getting myself ready for that, because that was like an hour and a half set.
Yep.
And I went and did that, and ever since then I've been fine. So that's how I did it. It was a little bit slow, but not that slow. It was just like a little bit at a time.
Mm.
Over a few weeks, but it certainly wasn't years or months.
Yeah, that's great. That's good news. Good news.
Thanks, mate.
No worries. You just came back from Blues Fest too, right?
Yes.
How was that?
Yeah, that was awesome. That was another big one. And I think they call it the Mojo stage, which is like one of the big tents there. And it was packed. Mm. And we had a great night. It was fabulous. Yeah, it's just, for me, great to be back doing that because I think, you know, while I was lying in hospital, I wasn't really sure what was going to happen.
Mm.
I think no one did. So it's just, what can I say? Just fantastic.
Mm. And you would have been probably sitting there thinking, oh, fuck, we just got through COVID.
Yeah.
We're back playing again and, you know, what's going on? What's going on here?
All that. Yeah, of course.
But yeah, it's sort of it really brings it home. Like I play in an over 45s soccer team, right?
And
we're very conscious in our group and our team of, you know, heart health and you know, getting out and getting checks done, and because you know everybody thinks that they're fine, until one day until one day you're not. So,
well, just on that, Stevie, and it's a good point you've raised, but for many years, or probably for the last 10 years leading up to this heart attack thing, I had a GP that wasn't really looking after me, wasn't really doing regular checks or even encouraging them, and that was my fault too. And I'm just thinking, oh, I'm going along and I'm fine, you know. And then, of course, this happened. And so now I have a GP that's right on to everything and regular checkups. And I think when you get a bit older, you have to do that. You have to have annual checkups and they have to be thorough.
Yep.
So that's the one thing I learned. And you're right, you know, we go along for years and think we're fine because we're younger or whatever. But yeah, it's really important.
Mm.
To keep a check on things properly.
Yep. And how do you find, do you have any sort of issues with you know, elbows, knees, hand joints, fingers, carpal tunnel or anything like that?
I've always been fairly lucky. You know, I've kind of built like a thoroughbred, I suppose, in a way.
Yep.
You know, I've been blessed with good genes from my mum and dad who were never really that overweight. And died in their 90s. So, you know, I've been pretty lucky in that regard. So everything still works pretty well. I mean, the only thing I notice is when I do a big gig now with, say, Mossy or even the Filthy Animals, I'm powering into it because I'm probably fitter now than I was, than I have been pre-heart attack.
Mm.
but I feel it the next day. So the recovery rate is longer, and that's just a natural thing because of my age. I mean, I'm turning 70 next week, so, yeah. You know, I'm getting up there. And, you know, the body just doesn't recover as quick.
All right, let's roll it back now. So you're a fellow Kiwi like myself. And you
still a Kiwi too.
Yeah, well, me too.
Yeah.
Oh, do you have your Australian passport?
No.
No, nor do I. I've still got a New Zealander. Same.
I don't know why. I never bothered to look into that. I've just, you know, trundled along with my Kiwi passport.
If it was it was a requirement to be here, like if we had to get it, I certainly would. But
I've never been bothered about it and never been told. Well, I mean, I moved over in 76 with Dragon, so I don't think there were the rules then than there are now.
Yep.
But I might look into it one day. I mean, my sister's become Australian and you know, some of my relatives, but yeah, I've always, I don't know. I don't see really the big deal, but maybe I should look into it. Thanks for reminding me.
No, that's all right. So you grew up in Wellington, which for people that don't know New Zealand, that's the bottom section of the North Island of New Zealand. Yeah. And I'm from Masterton, which is about an hour north in the Wairarapa, which is the next sort of region up.
Yeah.
Now, my mum and dad both grew up in Wellington as well, and I think you're similar age to my mum. I think she's 1953 and my dad's 1950. So my nana, my mum grew up in Nainai. And my dad grew up in Taita. So that was their areas. And then
the Taita was coastal.
No, Taita's, as you come, it's sort of the start of, or the end of the upper hut, start of lower hut, sort of.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it was along the way river. To Palmerston North, but.
Oh, no, it's
on the way.
It's on the way. I'm curious as to, you know, what the childhood was like there and when music started becoming really relevant to you and when you sort of. Did you hear something that made you want to become a musician, or how did that sort of unravel?
Yeah, it's a good question. It happened quite early on in my life for me. My father was kind of like a weddings, parties, anything pianist. He was a cocktail pianist. I've got to say, he was never blessed with great technique, but anyway, he used to love it, and he played right up to his older age. But anyway, he had a little kind of jazz trio, and they used to come and rehearse in our lounge room in Johnsonville, which is a suburb of Wellington where I grew up. I was born in Wellington, but I think when I was about 3 or 4, we moved to Johnsonville, and it's like a small country town connected to Wellington. But anyway, they used to come and rehearse and one day, I think I must have only been about 9 or 10, I'd already been learning piano with a private instructor, which I was kind of into. But anyway, I was really into what the drummer, what he was doing. He had a set of brushes and he was playing, you know, all that sort of swing stuff. And he handed me a spare set and he said, "Here, look, why don't you hold them like this?" And he put a piece of brown paper on a stool that we had in our lounge room. And he said, "Just follow me." And so I did, and I kind of got the bug. And then I remember it was probably, and I don't remember exactly when, but it wasn't long after that, because TV back then in New Zealand was black and white. And I remember seeing a clip of Gene Krupa playing on TV, and from then on, I just went, right, this is what I want to do. And I grew up with jazz and practicing the records and doing all that stuff. And then, to answer your question, it happened, I got the bug pretty early on, and ever since I haven't really looked back, because the bug's still there and it's still pretty powerful.
So you mentioned Gene Krupa. Who were some of the other drummers that you sort of honed into at that stage?
Well, probably through that era, it would have been Ed, a drummer named Ed Thigpen from the Oscar Peterson Trio, and that was one record. I've still got the CD, or the I think I've still got the album, Oscar Peterson Trio Plus One, Clark Terry on trumpet, and it's still one of my favourite albums. And Ed Thigpen is just the swing legend. He just swings like a monster, and that's the record I used to practice to in the lounge room while my dad was mowing the lawn and looking and giving me dirty looks because I wasn't helping him, all that stuff. But yeah, Ed Thigpen, and then of course, then I got into funk, jazz rock, which would have been Blood, Sweat and Tears, Chicago Transit Authority, as they were called then, and then I moved into rock. And then, of course, ended up in Sydney with Dragon, and on I went. But my roots will always, and still are, always be in jazz.
So growing up in New Zealand, and this is how it was for me. So it's sort of similar story. You know, my dad is a musician as well, and he's always played in bands. And you know, he used to, the bands that he was in, he used to bring them to our shed, and, you know, they'd rehearse, and then me and my brother would sit down and watch. And you know, I'd be watching the drummer and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So musicians were always around the house, so there was always there was always instruments there, and you know, we'd be going to jams. You know, there'd be parties at home, and the guitar would come out. And you know, Dad had some Maori friends and Polynesian friends, and there's a certain sort of way that they play, and there's a style.
Of
And
course, yeah.
that was always around, you know. So was that similar for you?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a good point. I relate to that totally because when I was in my, mid to late teens, and I shifted around a little bit. You know, I'd left home and I moved up to Palmerston North for a little while, and I got involved in with a lot of Maori families and Maori musicians, and of course they all. Well, I don't know if they do now, and I'm sure they do, but they then all lived together, right back to grandma and all the kids, they'd all live in the same house and they'd be jamming all the time. And so I used to go around and hop onto the stage with them or the shed, wherever they were. They taught me a lot, and a lot of those drummers, I used to watch them and talk to them, and they taught me so much, how to hit the snare drum, how to attack it, how to get the sound out of the kit, and then the whole thing, the whole groove thing as well. So I would say, apart from the jazz thing where I started, that whole Maori influence for me has been, it was a big deal, and I still look back on it and go, that was really important. It was a really important education for me.
How is your taste in music starting to change too? Well, I mean, obviously you're talking about soul and funk and that kind of stuff. So what sort of bands were you listening to, you know, sort of outside of these Maori families?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of the black bands from the US, Earth, Wind and Fire, Chaka Khan, Rufus, all of those bands. And then, of course, Boz Scaggs, Toto, Jeff Beccaro, Steve Gadd, all of that stuff. And I still listen to it now, but those guys to me are the guys. Yeah, that's the one. In fact,
I just bought it last week. So
yeah, cool. Interesting you've got that, because when that album came out, Boz Scaggs toured Australia, it would have been 77, maybe, you might know, 78, definitely late 70s. And Dragon got the support.
Oh,
And
really?
so I Yeah, and we'd just released, I think, April Sun or something. One of our songs was starting to do really well. And of course, April Sun did do well in the end, but I'll never forget that tour. And that's where I met Vanetta Fields, who was Boz's backing vocalist, one of his backing vocalists. And of course, she ended up moving out here then. But I used to have great conversations with her, after the gigs about, because she's. Well, back then, she was singing backing vocals on everything from Steely Dan to, like everything. Her catalogue is immense. And she was always wonderful to talk to about the drummers, you know, about all the guys that I idolised. In fact, Jeff Beccaro didn't come on that tour. It was
not Carlos Vega.
Yeah, Carlos Vega. Yeah, he was playing drums. It was a big band, you know, three horns, three backing vocalists. I think it was Steve Lukather on guitar. He was only about 16, 17 then. So it was a wonderful time. But anyway, it brought back a memory when you showed me that record.
Yeah. Talk about some of the early bands then that you got into around your area. And was it bands out of school or, you know, bands with people that you're meeting at the, you know, the jams that your dad was having or anything outside that?
So you mean as a young fella?
Yeah, yeah.
Before, yeah. It's a funny thing because, you know, through school and just after school, obviously Hendrix was huge and, you know, all those bands. But I wasn't into those. I wasn't into rock music then. I was still into jazz. So I was a bit looked upon bit weirdly, you know what I mean?
The jazz guy.
I was into a different...
Is that cool?
Yeah, he's weird, that guy. So through school, I wasn't really involved in bands at all because some of my mates that were or some of my acquaintances were playing rock music, but I wasn't into that at all. I think ZZ Top had just come out and all of that stuff, but it took me a while to kind of get into that genre. Pink Floyd, of course, Dark Side of the Moon was massive. And I used to go to parties and all of that stuff would be playing, but I just couldn't get into it. But I did start a little later on. I think the first move into that area for me was that Yes album, Close to the Edge. And I started to get into that with Bill Bruford on drums. And that's, I think, maybe the time when I started to move into. And certainly, like I said earlier, Chicago and Blood, Sweat and Tears. I actually saw Blood, Sweat and Tears live at the Wellington Town Hall.
Wow.
Back then. And that was quite an experience. So that was when I first started, because that to me, it still had a jazz swingy kind of flavor, but I was starting to move into the rock thing. Yeah. So back in school, I was a little bit different, I suppose, in that my musical tastes didn't really gel with anyone else's at the time, except myself.
Yeah. 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 That's all that matters in the end.
Yeah.
Well, not if it, well, up to a point where you need to make money to pay the bills sometimes. Eh?
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Yeah. How did we get to Dragon then? From there, how do, I'm just trying to work. I mean, you're a jazz guy, but you've been listening to all the Black American music, and you're into soul and funk and stuff, which you've picked up from the groups you're hanging out with in Palmerston North and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
how did we get to a point where you're asked to come and play for Dragon?
Okay, so we just go back a little bit from there. I used to go to the Wellington Musicians Club, which was this little dingy bar upstairs, and all the musos used to go there after their gigs.
So where was that located?
I can't actually remember the address.
Yeah, okay.
I just remember it was up the stairs, and there was always a drum kit there of somebody's, and anyone could get up and play. The thing, I just remember when I first came to Australia. Well, sorry, back in New Zealand, you were always encouraged to get up and have a jam and kind of learn your craft with other musicians. But when I came to Australia, that didn't exist.
Yeah,
I found that really strange.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it was like almost shunned upon. But anyway, getting back to the question. So it was at this jazz club that I met a bass player named Mark Hornibrook, who's a really good bass player. And he was involved in a band at the time called Mammal. And that band had Robert Taylor in it. So anyway, I'm playing in that band for a while. And we used to tour around the country. This is when I started to get into soul and funk and Aretha Franklin and all that sort of stuff. And we were playing material like that, Temptations, Four Tops. So I was getting into my rock groove or my funky rock groove. But Dragon at that time also existed in the original lineup, which had nothing to do with it. Was only Mark and Todd, the original people. It was a whole different band. Paul Houston wasn't in it at that point, and neither was Robert. And they had an old bus as well. We used to tour around the country in these old buses. We used to sleep in them. We had bunks, and we had all our gear in the back. It was amazing, really. And often we'd pass each other on the highway going different directions. But anyway, so what happened in the end, Mammal broke up. Robert ended up joining Dragon, and they came to Australia with the original drummer at the time, Neil Story. They'd been here about 12 months in Sydney, and, of course, they just recorded This Time with Neil on drums. And, of course, the story goes, unfortunately, Neil passed away from an accidental drug overdose. So because I had that connection with Robert and Mammal and all of that, I got the call. And it was a funny call because Mammal's manager at the time, he received an email from Todd that said, "Fame and fortune awaits." A telegram.
It would have been carrier pigeons back then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was a telegram. And fame and fortune awaits. So in those days, you could fly with your gear and your drums and all that stuff. So there was a ticket, an air ticket, and to Sydney with my drums, so off I went. So that's kind of the story. I landed in Sydney, and Mark picked me up from the airport. In the end, Mark and I were the only drivers in the band because no one else had a license. So we used to drive everywhere, but and that's how it happened. So that's how I got the gig. And the Sunshine album had pretty much been written, just about finished, and so I rehearsed that up. And they just got their deal with CBS Records, and then off we went. But it was kind of – it wasn't an overnight sensation by any means. Certainly, you know, we were doing a lot of gigs but for nothing, pretty much, just doing pub gigs and getting our shit together, I suppose. But that's how it happened.
So your first recording, the recording of that album, was that the first time you'd been in a studio?
Pretty much the first real time I'd been in a studio. Oh. I'd been in a studio in Wellington recording something for a jazz pianist, but nothing, I don't really remember it, to be honest. But, yeah, that was the first time I'd been in with a producer recording original songs.
And where was that? Where was that first?
That was recorded at a studio called Albert's in Sydney. Mm-hmm. It's probably not there anymore. But
and where did that used to be?
Don't even remember the name of the street, but it was off George Street.
In town, right, okay.
I think it's where AC/DC recorded their first album too, because I think Angus's – I think the – oh, what was Angus's brother's name? Who was the producer? I think he worked there anyway, but okay. He didn't produce our album, but he was based in that studio.
So how long was that session for that album?
Oh, mate, you're going back a long time now. I can't remember.
No, fair enough. Was it a matter of weeks or was it something done over a few days?
No. It was probably... Yeah, it was probably only, you know what, I can't remember, but it was probably no more than a week.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, we knew all the songs. It was like just play them a couple of times.
Yep.
Put them down and bang, and off you go.
No sort of overdubbing, it was just...
Oh, definitely overdubbing.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah.
And so from the point that album was recorded... How long was it till it was released, and what were you sort of doing in between? I guess you still would have been stacked with gigs and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, back then, I mean, bands worked all the time, as you probably remember. You know, you could go to any pub on any street corner any night of the week pretty much in Sydney or Melbourne or anywhere, and there'd be a band playing, and mostly original bands as well. Just, you know, I remember, you know, Roast Tattoo, the Angels, all those bands, oh, a little later on, you know, all cutting their teeth in pubs before they got their record deals and before they became well known. There were gigs anywhere, and you've got to remember, this is pre-poker machines and all that, which you know, I think that era kind of ruined a lot of things for live performance as well. I remember the RSL clubs in Australia just had live bands on all the time. But as soon as the pokies came in, it kind of changed.
It did, big time. What were some of the hits off that? I've just got the track listing now for Sunshine, so...
I think the main mild hit, we didn't have a number one off that album, but I think it was Get That Jive.
Oh, Get That Jive, right.
Was maybe, you know, in the top 10 or something, which was pretty exciting. I remember being in the old Chrysler Valiant band car, you know, with the old bench seat in the front.
Yeah, so my dad had one.
Six up in the with the manager in the middle.
Yeah.
And he was the shortest, so he'd be in the middle in the front. And Mark and I'd be driving. Mark or I would be driving.
With the column
and
change.
And hearing Get That Jive on the radio.
Yeah, wow.
It was pretty exciting.
That is cool. And so from that point then, was the hype starting to build? Were people starting to take notice?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I remember going to parties and people had that album and they'd play it. And, you know, it was like, oh, wow, I'm a rock star.
Yeah. But it's only going to get bigger. You had no idea, right?
Yeah. It certainly got bigger on the second album. Obviously, Running Free had April Sun on it.
Yep.
And then, of course, the third album, Ozambezi, had Are You Old Enough, which was our first number one.
Okay.
And that went to number one while we were in the US on our infamous disastrous tour of America.
All right. Well, that's piqued my interest, you saying your infamous disastrous tour of America. So, all right. So you need to. Oh, is it? All right. Okay. It's already there. Okay, I'll look it up.
Well, yeah. Oh no, I can talk. I don't mind talking about.
Oh, great.
It.
Awesome. Well, okay. Well, I'm not aware of it. And to save me the Google. If you can summarize it, yeah.
So what happened? We were with CBS Records. We did the Ozambezi album. And then Portrait Records, which was a American subsidiary of CBS, put us on a tour in the US with Johnny Winter. Now, I'm sure you know who Johnny Winter is. He's a blues artist. And our first gig was in a bar in Texas. And if you remember those scenes in the Blues Brothers with the bar and the chicken wire. We didn't have chicken wire, but anyway, it was kind of like that. And so here's this kind of little white pop band from Australia or from New Zealand playing pop songs with Johnny Winter, who was a, you know, deep blues band at these clubs in the US. So we were getting booed. And anyway, our first gig in Texas, it was the Armadillo Club. I can't remember the name of the city, but anyway, it's probably still there. The Armadillo Club. It's really famous. You know, you'd walk backstage into the green room, down the corridor, and there'd be posters of Frank Zappa and all these amazing bands that had played there. Anyway, so we're playing away, and Mark Hunter, in his wisdom, decided to. And this is all on the internet. He decided to stand up at the microphone in a crucifix position with his arms out and call John Wayne a f- And, of course, we had beer cans pelted at us and we had to run for our lives. And apparently I heard later, I think Todd was telling me, Todd's told the story many times, the record company were taking bets as to who was going to get shot first. It was pretty bad. But anyway, from then on, they dropped us and we finished the tour, but it was just a disaster. And then we came back to Australia. I think it was just before Christmas, and Are You Old Enough had gone number one. So we kind of took off from there. Yeah, Big story.
Oh, wow.
Mark, he was so unpredictable, but he was amazing as well.
I spoke to there's a band in New Zealand called Cora, and I spoke to the lead singer of that band. Oh, this was back in 2018, and they did a tour of America, and at that time they had this system where if you get booked for a gig and you're at the gig, they had this book, right? And it's kind of like a, I don't know, that if you play that gig and you bomb and you're no good, this sort of information gets sort of uploaded into this book and it gets passed around. And by the time the band gets to the next venue, that venue knows about the last gig, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm just, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's a lot quicker sort of back then. Well, no, this would be really early internet, I suppose, that would have happened for them.
Oh.
But for you guys, was it a case of, okay, this has happened, so now they know where you're going to be next. Do they get in touch with each other and you know, sort of?
I think from what I remember, we just got dropped like hotcakes from the record company.
Just like that, right.
But we continued with the tour, but it wasn't a great experience for us at all. Why would you put us on a tour with Johnny Winter? It's completely wrong.
Right. Okay. So are you old enough, number one, and you're back in town? So, I can imagine. So when?
So that would have been 1979, I think.
Okay. So when you hit the ground back in Australia, at what point did you find out that you were number one? Was there somebody waiting for you at the airport with the news, or?
I can't remember, to be honest. It's so long ago.
Yep.
But it was probably our manager Sebastian Chase at the time. But anyway, shall I keep going with the kind of history and what happened next?
Yep. Before you carry on there, I'm just curious as to the reaction and. Well, like you said, it's a long time ago, so maybe you don't sort of remember too much. But that's, you know, hitting number one, that's a big deal. So that must have been a buzz. So was there sort of any immediate sort of, I don't know, how do you take that in? You've got a number one song.
I think for me, you know, I've got to say I was young and stupid, really. I was playing music for the fun of it,
yep,
and the buzz, but also the touring and the meeting people and the parties and, you know, all that stuff. So I was young and crazy, really, and had the energy to be like that too, as we all did. But you know, looking back on it now, yeah, I wasn't very smart about the whole thing. But, yeah, it was certainly a buzz to have a number one single, but from there it kind of got a bit weird because Todd and Mark weren't getting on. Mark was kind of going down a one-way road because Mark was basically into the good life and into anything he could get his hands on. And so Todd decided to sack Mark, and we broke up for a while. We broke up for a couple of years. And you might remember, you might not know, there is an album. We actually got a different singer and an electric violinist and together, and we made another album.
Right.
And it wasn't a great album, and it bummed out. It didn't do anything. But in the end, 1982 came around and we decided to reform the original band with Mark. And that's when we did the Body and the Beat album, and I played Rain. And then we went on and did another tour. And then, of course, I left. This is like a brief, this is the way it happened.
Mm.
I left in 83, I think, after recording Rain, and went on to do all my other stuff because I just had enough. like I said before, we were touring all the time. Bands were just, they just didn't stop. There was so much work and so many gigs. And, of course, everyone drove then as well. You'd be driving everywhere because flying was expensive. So, yeah, I quit and moved on, and then they went on to form other lineups, other drummers. They had Terry Chambers from XTC after me. Then they had Doan Perry for a while. Tommy Emmanuel joined, who I actually saw at Blues Fest.
Oh, cool.
I hadn't seen him probably since back then. It was great to catch up with him. And, of course, they went on to do a lot of other stuff until Mark passed away. And now it is what it is. Dragon, I mean.
Yeah, yep. Can I ask you about, as a drummer, you know, I've, you know, what I should have said this earlier too. Like, as a drummer, having played in many a cover band in my life, you know, a lot of songs that have been in repertoires of bands that I've played have been Rain and April Sun in Cuba, of course. And I'm sure that's not the first time you've heard that.
Yeah.
I love playing Rain. It's one of my favorite songs to play.
Really?
Yeah. Now, do you remember your process of creating that drum part? Or was it just a case, like, was there any sort of, because what, you know, for people that haven't heard the song, go and listen to it, but it's the drums are a little bit unpredictable in regards where, like, instead of just a, you do, every now and then you drop this little, I listen to that and I try and find a pattern of where that is, but there's no pattern to it, eh?
No, there is no pattern. It's just me. It's just my brain. I think the way I've always played is I've always played songs. I've never played as a drummer. If you know what I mean, it's probably not. I'm probably not explaining it that well.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yep.
Yeah, when I hear a song, I'll play the song for the way I feel it needs to be played, rather than play it as a drummer or a drum solo. So I'm actually adding something to it. And so a lot of those offbeats that you hear, they never planned. They're just like, they just feel right to do at the time.
Yep.
And that's how I've always played. So there's never a process with me. It's always just, I guess, from the heart or from the soul.
Mm.
It's always from deep within. So yeah, I could not explain how I played that song to you, other than it just needed to have a driving force behind it.
Yep.
And fortunately, we'd just gotten Alan Mansfield on board to produce, and that was the first time we'd gone away from Peter Dawkins, who produced all the earlier albums. And so suddenly, Alan, who came from Robert Palmer's thing in the US, is American. Alan and ended up joining
sound,
the band, of course.
The sound would have opened right up then.
Oh yeah, yeah. And, I mean, even to this day, I think I still listen to when I hear Rain. I still think, well, yeah, it still sounds quite current.
It does. Yeah,
just
yep.
The sound of it. He's just got a great drum sound. And Robert always says to me, you know, the way I played that, it was like I couldn't wait to get that over with, so I could get out and go and. Go and score some drugs or go and get pissed.
Yeah.
Which is probably true.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I don't do drugs anymore, by the way.
No, that's cool. Nor do I. It is a very driving song, and it's like the bass and the drums obviously drive the song, but it's the guitar in there as well, eh? It just adds. It's just all motion. It's all.
It is.
It's all forward motion.
Very forward.
Yep.
Forward moving.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And and that's why it's just
so much
fun to play.
We actually played in the Filthy Animals as well, and we do April Sun in Cuba.
That was a question I was going to ask you when we got to talking about the Filthy Animals. As a cover band, do you play Dragon covers?
Yeah, we do. We only do those two.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
Oh, we used to do Young Years as well, but
okay.
We haven't played that for a while, but
right.
But those two are the like they're the big songs that we do. And we do, of course, we've got Brett Williams from the Choir Boys. We do Run to Paradise as well. You know, all those songs, but the big hits. But Rain, I still love playing it too. And April Sun, it says April Sun's another one that's got certain fills in it that to me they have to be played. Well, they don't have to be, but I just feel I have to play them a certain way to make that song work. Like, for example, going into a chorus, it might be and I'll always push that first beat going into the one beat of the chorus. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's almost like here's the chorus now, but I'm going to tell you where it is just a little bit sooner.
Get you on your toes. You know what I mean. I do.
I don't know. That's just how I approach things. I always try to, I suppose, lead the band. It's interesting too with Mossy, with Ian Moss. I do the same thing. I mean, him and I've been playing together for so many years. We kind of read each other's minds almost. So when he's soloing, I'll go with him, or I'll do something that sets him up, and he'll do something alongside that. So it's almost a telepathic thing. But those things are always soul based. They're always from within. You know, they're like, you can't plan or predict that stuff. It just happens on the night. I think what I'm trying to say is I could never play a song the same way twice. So if we come to the next night, I might play it a little differently. The feels might be a little different. The feel will be the same, but you know, I'm not one of those guys that can work out all my fills for a song and play them exactly the same every night. I couldn't do that.
Gotcha.
I just couldn't remember.
Gotcha. And I was let
the song take me.
Yeah. It's interesting as a, you know, as since I've been doing this podcast, you know, I've sat back and I've analyzed hundreds of songs from all the people that I've talked to. And we've even done episodes where we spotlight, you know, some of our favorite musicians. So, for example, we did a spotlight on Jeff Beccaro and Steve Gadd and Jaco Pastorius and a couple of others. So that's just a bunch of us just breaking songs down, right?
Yeah.
And what ends up always happening is one of the guys will say, well, one of us will say, you know what, when he played that, he probably had no idea what he was playing. He just felt it. But then it takes a, you know, some music geeks to sit down and analyze the songs, and it's like I'm just saying to you about Rain, how I've sort of sat back and worked out how you played it, and you know, in the back of my mind, it's like, yeah, I'm sure you felt it, but I just had to ask that question about, you know, was there a process to that song, because you know it's very unique.
Yeah, thanks, Stevie. No, that's okay. I mean, my answer is just, I don't think there was anything worked out. It was just the feel of the song. It just took – that's where it took me, and that's how I played it. And that's how I probably still play it.
Yep. You know what? Next time I hear it, I'm going to hear you wanting to quickly get it over and done with, leave the room and go and get drunk.
Yeah, well, it might be a good approach. I'm pretty sure that's what was going on. Robert's got a better memory than me, for sure.
Speaking of that, I was, you know, obviously doing some research to this. I, you know, did a bit of a deep dive and looked around, and there's a video on the Dragon YouTube page of a whole bunch of stories. Well, there's a bunch of stories that you guys sort of tell, right? And one of them.
Was when we were inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame.
Oh, was it? Yeah, right. Okay.
I think we did that for that. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, there's a couple of things being done like that.
Right, but what sort of got me interested? And you even mentioned it too before about how you and Mark were the only two sort of drivers in the band.
Yeah.
And I think Robert said that there was an incident going down Bullo Pass or something with the van or the car sort of went off the edge of the nearly went off the edge of a cliff. And then he also said there's a whole bunch of other sort of driving stories that if it wasn't for you, and I think it was Marcus who he said, you know, you all wouldn't be here. So can you recall, can you recall any of those other hairy driving stories?
No, I can't recall the scary ones. I don't remember the scary ones. I just remember doing a lot of overnighters. So, you know, I remember Mark one night in Sydney picked me up from a party with the rest of the band in the Chrysler Valiant. I think it was called an AP5, that Chrysler Valiant. I could be wrong. But anyway, he picked me up from a party about midnight, and we were driving to Melbourne. You know, we'd do that. And then we'd get to near Melbourne, and we'd, you know, about 9 o'clock in the morning, and we'd pull into a high school, a girls' high school, and do a performance, like, because the road crew had already set up there.
Right.
And I remember this one time, we're in this Catholic school, and there were all these nuns, and Mark was doing his thing, and all the young girls ran up to the front of the stage throwing panties at him and bras, and the nuns were freaking out. It was like nuts. And then, so then we get back in the car and we drive to Melbourne, and then we do an evening at a pub about 8 o'clock, and then we do a nightclub, a 2 a.m.er, you know, around in St Kilda or something. That's how it was then. It was wow, like amazing time. It's not like that now.
No. Okay, so you've left Dragon. So when you left Dragon, did you have something lined up straight afterwards, or did you take a bit of time to decompress?
I took a little bit of a break. I went down to Melbourne, and I stayed there for 6 months, and I played. Ended up joining up with Billy Miller's band called the. Billy Miller was from a band called the Ferrets, and they had a kind of a. I think they had a mild hit, Don't Fall in Love, it was called. Mm. And he went out on his own, and he had this band, and, you know, it was just like, it was a shitty band. But anyway, I did that for a while. I think I just needed a break and just to keep playing but not do too much. And then in the end I went to Adelaide after that and spent another 6 months down there playing in a pretty – average band, and that's when I it's funny because I was in this band and it wasn't great, and we supported Cold Chisel on one of their first East concerts at the Adelaide, I think it was Festival Hall or one of those ones in Adelaide, I don't remember what it was called, and I remember being at the bar later, and Steve Prestwich, who was a mate of mine, came up to me and said, "What the fuck are you doing?" Like, because I was in this band that after doing what I'd done, and anyway, it kind of opened my eyes. I thought to myself, yeah, you're right. Anyway, I ended up going back to Sydney and did a little bit of playing with Lobby Lloyd and the Coloured Balls, I think they were called then, and then joined up with Kevin Borich Express and played with them for a couple of years. And then that was in the hiatus, like the breakup period, the 2 years that Dragon broke up. So there's 82, Dragon got back together, and that's when we did the Rain thing.
Yep.
So that was after Kevin Borich. So yeah, that's what I did in the meantime.
With the success that you had with, you know, the sort of the chart success, did that set you up in a way financially? I mean, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I'm just curious as to, you know, when you make the decision to leave, you know, a band like that. I mean, obviously there's a whole lot going on. It was busy and they're, you know, in a turmoil and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to be able to walk away from it, did you have a little bit of, I don't know, security to keep you going for a little while?
Well, short answer is no.
Okay.
Like I said earlier, I was just young and stupid and a party animal. Okay. And, you know, I wasn't in it for fortune in those days. And so, yeah, silly me. But
So you obviously didn't read the Telegram properly then?
I'd forgotten about the Telegram. Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't a business head at all back then.
Yeah, okay. Understood. All right, so what was next after Dragon?
After Dragon, okay, so I left in 83 and then I messed around for a while. I moved to Newcastle where my mum was living. And I played for a short while in a band called DV8, who are still around actually in Newcastle and still quite popular. And then in the end, my mum and dad had actually moved to the Gold Coast. And in the end, I needed a break, so I came up and stayed with them for a while, and that's when I decided to look at staying up here. Mm. I got into the conservatorium, into the jazz course, because I wanted to get I did an arranging course because I wanted to get into some songwriting. Because like I said earlier, I was always as a player, I've always been into songs and where they take you. So I did that. That took a couple of years. And then I started teaching in schools, just part-time. And then so I was living in Brisbane. I'd graduated from the con and I got back. Kevin Boritz got back in touch with me, said, I've got a tour of North Queensland. Do you want to come? So I did that. And then shortly after that, Mossy got in touch with me. This would have been 1992, 93, and said, I'm doing a tour of Germany. Do you want to come? And so that's when I hooked up with Ian. And that's kind of what I've been doing ever since, apart from a few other things. You know, I played with Russell Morris. I've done Reno Gaia tours, Mondo Rock, and all of those. And here I am now, still here in Brisbane.
So you get called up to play with Ian Moss. So can you remember the first time, I guess going out to seeing Chisel, you know, play gigs off the East album, right? Is that when you kind of, did you know the rest of the guys in the band? I mean, you said you knew Steve Prestwich before that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
from the Dragon days, I mean, because those bands used to cross paths all the time and we'd be doing gigs together. You know, I remember Dragon used to do, earlier on, we supported, Shirley Strawn's band. I'm having a memory lapse. you're having one
Red Simons.
Red Simons, yeah. Anyway, we do gigs all the time. The Bondi Lifesaver was one of the bigger venues where all the bands played, and we'd always be playing together or we'd be crossing paths somewhere. So, yeah, to answer your question, I did know the Chisel guys. In fact, Ian doesn't remember this, but when I was with Dragon and he was with Chisel in the early days in the 70s, I shared a house with Harvey James from Sherbet.
Right.
And Ian Moss, he was living there too, but he doesn't remember me living there.
Really?
But the three of us were there. So, yeah, we kind of all go way back. In fact, I remember getting up one morning or afternoon and hearing Ian in the shower singing Georgia, which was pretty special.
I've been listening to those couple of albums that you told me that you played on. I've been listening to them the last few days.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, man, I mean, I used to play in a Chisel cover band, right? So I knew sort of Mossy's. Well, let me sort of backtrack a little bit. When I first came to Australia, I didn't know who Cold Chisel was.
Yeah.
Right. And then I was looking for a band, and do you remember the old Drum Media magazine?
The newspaper,
yeah. So there was the adverts in the back for bands. So anyway, there was a Cold Chisel cover show looking for a drummer. So anyway,
yeah,
and I hadn't heard Cold Chisel. Oh, sorry, no, I'd heard K San. That's the only one I'd heard. And yep. So anyway, I went into a room and learned all the songs and ended up playing in this band for a couple of years and learning all the Chisel stuff and then sort of getting right into Mossy and really at that stage realizing just how much of a world-class guitar player he was, right?
Oh, yeah.
When he sort of first started doing the solo stuff, then I sort of listened to that, Tucker's Daughter and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, but listening to those two albums.
Is it the live one or just the studio one from 2018 and then the recent one we did last year?
No, oh, sorry, there's the three.
There's a live one.
Yeah.
There's a studio album from 2018, then a live one from that tour. And then there's the new studio album we did last year.
Yep. And that
which
that
has got one of my songs on it, actually.
Oh, really? Which one's your one?
Yeah. The Wish. And on that album is a live version of it from our tour last year as well. There's a studio version and a live version.
Okay. Can you hear this?
No.
Got another new song from the Rivers Run to Hell.
Oh, yeah.
This is called The Wish.
Yeah, that's it.
Drums sound awesome.
I can't hear it.
Oh, okay. I'm a loosening time. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one of my first songs that's ever been recorded.
That's great,
really,
man.
Special.
That's great. Yeah. And you got a credit on it?
Yeah, well, I wrote it.
Yeah, it's okay, great.
Just me. There's another track, a really funky one you might like on that same album that I co-wrote with Ian. I was just trying to find what it was called. I can't remember. I haven't heard it since last year.
Is it Open Your Eyes?
No.
Oh, I love that
song. Written by Diesel.
Really? Right. That is fantastic.
Go down the song list and I'll tell you which one it is.
Okay, so from the top, River Runs Dry, Nullarbor Plain, State of Emotion, Bury Me.
That's it.
State of Emotion.
State of My Emotion. Should
State
have
of
listened
My Emotion.
To that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
who's playing piano on that?
Lachlan. Oh, sorry, Clayton. Holy waters raining down on me. An unexpected kindness in a time without mercy. As I travel down this lonesome road to the beat of my own drum, I'm black and blue but staying true to what I have become. I will not be broken.
Yeah, that's cool, man. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that the whole album's great, and the live versions of those songs is awesome.
Yeah, so, yeah, thanks, Stevie.
Can I ask you what when Mossy wants to go in and record an album? So do you go in there and he's written all the songs, or does he? Is it sort of like a pre-production thing where you know what you know what you're going in to do?
No, there's definitely a pre-production rehearsal. We have a rehearsal first to chip away at the new material, whoever might have written it, and it's not always Ian. And then we go into the studio and we chip away again, and then we lay the tracks down.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a – with Ian it can be a little bit of a long process. Longer than, you know, some artists, but you know, usually the result's pretty good.
I was going to say that you can hear it in the results that it's not just a few days in the studio like this.
No,
they're quality songs like the
Well, we had for that reasonably good engineer as well. We recorded that at Rancom, which is Garth Porter's studio in Sydney. And we've recorded there the last album as well. It's just a really cool studio. It's a big room with, several isolation rooms as well for amps and things. But we can all be in the same room together, which is fantastic, with the drums.
Right.
So you've kind of still got that connection. And they've got a lot of kind of hard outboard hardware plugins and things, even though you're recording on Pro Tools, you're going through, I think, an SSL desk. So he was a great engineer. But then it was also mixed by a guy in the US. So, good result.
And, yeah, top result.
You know, a lot of procedures on the way. takes a lot of time.
Mm.
Well, Ian takes a lot of time.
Yep. Now, how have those new songs been received?
We only Nullarbor Plain was the first single, and that was co-written by Troy Cassidaly. On last year's tour, we did Rivers Run Dry. We only did about four songs off that album, but okay. Open Your Eyes is definitely another one we did. Plus, we did The Wish, song.
Yep.
But Open Your Eyes is the next single, as far as I'm aware.
Okay.
We didn't do the whole album, if that's what you mean.
So how was it playing your song Wish to a crowd for the first time? What was that like?
It was a little bit nerve-wracking because, you know, it's like, oops, I wrote this one. I wonder how this is going to go. And it's a hard one to play too because it's so back in its feel.
Yep.
If you listen to the studio version, you'll hear what I mean.
Yep.
With the live version, we brought the tempo up a little, but it's just one of those ones that's really hard. It's really hard to hold back for me anyway.
Right.
You know, I'd never say my tempos are perfect, but I try. But it's just one of those songs. It's hard to play. We haven't played it for a while now. It's one that we probably should keep playing for a while to really get, you know, get a handle on it live. I mean,
yep. So is there more Ian Moss shows coming up soon?
Yeah. Well, we just did Blues Fest, as you said.
Yep.
The next one for us is a Big Red Bash at Birdsville in July, and then shortly after that we go to the UK and we've got some dates over there, Glasgow and London, and then we come back and we do Monday. That's another bash festival in the middle of the desert.
Yep.
And then we've got some gigs coming up. The band gigs really start ramping up towards the end of the year after that and into 2025.
Mm-hmm.
So, because at the moment he's still finishing off this solo tour, so that's taking up a bit of time.
Yep. So Mondo Rock, so you were the original drummer for Mondo Rock, but you never recorded with Mondo Rock, is that right?
Correct, yeah. When Dragon broke up in that two-year period between 1980 and 82,
yep.
I bumped into Ross Wilson at the Mansell Room, which is a famous nightclub. It's probably not there now. And he said, hey, I've got this new band. I want to record this new album, the Chemistry album. Do you want to come to Melbourne and record it? So I said, yeah, no worries. So we flew down together and we started in the studio. I think I was in the band for about 3 weeks rehearsing the Chemistry album. But without going into detail, I was a bit of a tearaway then, and I was kind of a bit messed up.
Mm-hmm.
So Ross let me go.
Mm.
So JJ Hackett ended up doing the album and obviously staying with Mondo's for a few years. But in 2006, I think it was, this UK tour came through Australia. All these UK artists, and they needed some Australian bands. And we were one of them. I think Choir Boys or Mark Gable, one of the two, were another one. But anyway, there were only a couple of Australian acts, and Mondo Rock were one of them. And Ross rang me up and said, hey, look, you were the original member in the band. Should we get this together? And so it was the actual original lineup did that tour. That was in that rehearsal room, but never recorded. And so it went so well that we decided, we did a few other gigs, corporate things and things, but then we got the Countdown tour, which I think was, that might have been 2006. The one I was talking about might have been a year or so earlier.
Mm.
I can't quite remember, but the Countdown tour was the big Gadinsky thing. That was the live thing that went around Australia. It was amazingly successful, but Mondo's did that as well. And ever since then, we kind of kept it going as the original lineup. So, yeah, that's kind of like the long story short.
I interviewed Paul Christie. It was during COVID, actually. Yeah, and yeah, he was. We didn't talk that much about Mondo Rock, but he was saying that it was definitely at a time where you guys sort of had gigs booked, but then because of COVID, they got cancelled. You know, yeah, almost to a point where you walk. Yeah. He was saying that at one point you're literally walking out the door with your luggage.
Yeah.
You know, to get into a cab or an Uber or whatever, and then there's a phone call and it's off. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That happened a couple of times to the Mondos. Yeah.
Yeah.
Strange times.
Strange times, all right. Let's talk about gear for a little bit. Drummer to drummer.
Yeah.
Now, way back when I was young, the brand Dixon, I don't know, it didn't really sort of have such a great name with drums.
No, right? No, it was shit.
It was shit. Yep.
Yeah, it was. It was cheap.
Yeah, it really was.
Stuff.
Yep. And that's sort of come right around now because, you know, you in Australia, you know, you're definitely you know, pushing the brand of Dixon, and then the sort of the international guy that I can think of, you know, sort of pushing
Greg Bissonette,
yeah, exactly. So tell me how you got how Dixon drums sort of came on the scene for you.
I've been endorsed by a few companies. D-Drum was an earlier one, and then it became Crush.
Yep.
And I think Crush came from another company. I've still got those drums. They're actually beautiful drums.
Nice drums, yeah.
Yeah, and then the Dixon thing came around from Pro Music, which is it's the warehouse based in Brisbane here. They're the importers. And they also do Boss for Cymbals, which they also endorse me with. And I love Turkish cymbals. You can't beat them. They're all handmade and brilliant. But it came about, so Dixon, like you said, or like I said, they used to be pretty crappy drums. But I think the story goes, and I might be wrong here, that they're a Taiwanese company, but they actually make a lot of the shells, the high-end shells for all the other companies, Tama, Yamaha, Pearl. Now, I could be wrong, so don't quote me on that one. But because of that, they decided to make their own high-end kits, which is how this and, of course, Pro Music, I knew the marketing guy there, and he rang me up and said, hey, you know, do you want to get involved? We can supply you a kit. We'll even custom make it for you. What color do you want? What shells?
Oh, cool.
And that's the first time that's ever happened to me. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll come on board. I've got a maple shell. I love maple shell. Bright yellow, why not?
Yep.
And they're brilliant. They're beautiful. And their hardware is really good too. So
yeah, so okay, so Dixon make their own hardware, do they?
Yeah, yeah. They make the cheap stuff still, and yep, they make the high-end stuff. So I've got the whole rig, which you'll see in a lot of the because the Filthy Animals, going back to them briefly for a second, we have a YouTube channel and we've done a lot of live recording and studio recording with different lineups of that band,
yep,
with that kit. So you'll see it. That's probably the main place you'll see that kit.
I'm looking at it right now, but it's audio, so everyone else can't see it. But yeah, I'm looking at it. I'm on your Facebook page. It's kind of a bird's eye shot. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Very nice. That was just some recent recording we did only last Monday with a young singer from Sydney who you might know, Reese Maston.
Oh, really? Okay, great. So, awesome.
Yeah, he's jumped in and done six songs. They're about to be released on YouTube. So actually a new one coming out tomorrow. So check out our Facebook page. Sorry, not Facebook, YouTube, our YouTube channel.
Yep.
It's called Filthy Animals.
Filthy Animals. And, I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great. And you'll hear that kit, and it sounds amazing on this. We did, he did a version of Born to Be Wild. So, and it's killer. Yeah, the drums sound great. So,
that's cool.
I think you'll love it.
That's awesome. Because that's a drum heavy song, that one. Born to be.
Yeah, all that.
Cool, man. That's really good.
I messed up the first fill in it. You know, the big da-da-loom, 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 da-da-loom. I messed up that one, but wait till you hear the ending.
Everybody
made up for it.
Everybody does.
Yeah. I can't believe I messed it up. I had it perfect.
Yeah. Oh, it's always the way.
Roll camera.
No, yeah, yeah. Good stuff. All right, Kerry, man, thanks for spending your evening with me.
Hey, no worries, Stevie, anytime. And, yeah, like I said, let's do it again sometime whenever you're ready.
Yeah, and I'll
just talk about the same stuff again.
I'm sure there's heaps we didn't talk about too. So,
well, yeah. there's stuff I probably don't want to talk about.
No, of course. Yeah, no, good stuff, Kerry. All right, man, look after yourself. I'm glad you're healthy.
Thank you, mate.
Stay healthy, man, and hopefully I'll catch you at a gig soon.
Yeah, I'll see you in Sydney sometime. I think we're in I think the Filthies are coming to the Bridge Hotel.
Really?
Sometime in the next couple of months. So
I'll look that up.
Keep an eye out. And if you wanna hop along to that gig, let me know and we can meet up.
That'd be great. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome, man.
Cool.
All right, Kerry, take it easy, bud. Thanks, man.
Yeah, you too.
All right.
See you, Stevie. Bye-bye.
Yo, it's Stevie here. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you dig the Gig Life podcast, please subscribe, share, leave a review. Please follow us on Instagram and TikTok. You can send me a message if you have an idea for a guest or if you just want to say hello. This podcast is free, costs you nothing. But if you find the value in the Gig Life podcast, you can leave a tip or a donation. Links are in the show notes on your app. That's it for me for now. Catch you next time, guys. Cheers.